Hello and welcome to another episode of the County Cricket Podcast. I'm your host, Aaron, aka the Cricket Connoisseur, and joining me on my left, as always, is my Lancashire co-host, Joe Nutsy Nuttall. So Joe, mate, how's your day been so far?
Yeah, not bad, to be honest. I'm pretty buzzing again from the football last night. It feels like I say that every episode now. Yeah, well, it's a good time to be a United fan, I guess. But yeah, I'm good, thank you.
That's good to hear. But yeah, football aside then, we are also joined by a very, very special guest on the County Cricket Podcast today. We are joined by Worcestershire All-Rounder and Chairman of the PCA, Daryl Mitchell. So first things first, Daryl, thank you very much for coming on to our podcast today, mate. How's your day been so far?
Yeah, thanks for having me. Yeah, it's been hectic, half term, kids off school, so running around. So if you have any shouting, I apologise for that. But they are around. But I've shut the door and hopefully locked myself away for the foreseeable.
Do you remember that? Was it on Sky? It was like a Sky News interview, and it was this guy, and it's like the head of defence or something. And then his kids came into the room afterwards. Yeah. Can we expect a repeat of that today, Daryl?
Possibly, quite possibly. I think it's sort of a bit of a working from home through the COVID thing. I think it's probably happened in a lot of households over the last sort of couple of months.
Yeah, well, we'll hope not. But of course, anything can happen during these times, can't they, with Zoom?
Absolutely. Expect the unexpected.
Exactly, a lesson that's been taught to us all. But for the listeners at home then, today's podcast, we're going to be talking through Daryl's early cricketing journey, talking through his time at Worcestershire, and then we're of course going to conclude today's podcast by talking about everyone's favourite segment, which is of course teammates. So Daryl, to kickstart the podcast then, let's start right at the beginning of your cricketing journey then. What's your first ever memory of cricket, either playing or watching the game?
I mean, I've got the sort of obligatory pictures of me in a cot with a bat. I don't quite remember it, but I've seen the pictures from myself from a very early age of a little mini bat sort of in the cot, only obviously a few weeks old probably looking at the pictures. But first memories really are playing the grand's house a lot in the back garden, going to watch my dad play club cricket down at a little club called Badsey Cricket Club, and the odd Sunday league game sort of down at New Road, again with my dad watching cricket on a sort of that successful Worcestershire period, I guess, that late 80s, early 90s with the Both and Dilly sort of era.
Fair enough, very, very early to get into cricket.
Yeah, I think it was inevitable, really. My dad's obviously a big cricket man and, yeah, just followed in his footsteps, really, and loved the game from a very early age.
Fair enough. And, of course, you've kept that love all the way to this day, really. But you mentioned your family then. But who in the cricketing world itself, who did you really look up to in those early days as a cricketer?
I think both them and Graham Hick were probably my two sort of real idols as a real youngster, obviously being Worcestershire born and a Worcestershire fan. So those two really stood out. I think away from that, probably Mike Atherton through the sort of early 90s, a little bit later as that sort of tough, sort of disciplined opening batsman, I suppose. That's sort of what I tried to model myself on a little bit, sort of going through those sort of teenage years, I guess, and the early sort of cricketing. My early cricketing performances.
Fair enough, some good choices there. Joe, what about you? What about from the 80s and 90s? Who really stood out to you from a cricketing perspective?
Put me on the spot here. Gonna have to go back a few years. I mean, I guess sort of, obviously I wasn't alive, by the way, in like the 80s and 90s. So I didn't ever like see, but I did see actually this particular person I'm about to say live eventually, and that's Shane Warne. Sort of when he sort of first came onto the scene, I imagine, but I can clearly see actually that, you know, he was... People will be able to tell he's going to be a superstar because right from, you know, the ball of the century that he bowled, people could see that. So I guess Shane Warne would definitely be up there. Obviously, I wasn't alive, so I couldn't say that firsthand, but that's just the impression I get.
Fair enough. Yeah, same here. That's relatable. Only 19. But someone, of course, as a Warwickshire fan, I wish I was alive to see it, though, the treble season in 94. Brian Charles Lara, what a player. Brilliant batsman, one of the greatest of all time. Warwickshire legend. See, I think he'd be up there for me personally.
Yeah, he's outstanding, isn't he? He is a legend. Phenomenal cricketer. Yeah,
I think
sure.
I think those sort of world record breaking feats for the West Indies. I remember actually watching both of those innings, obviously to go past Sobers originally, and then to reclaim it with the 400. They were pretty special innings, weren't they? I think he was obviously a superb time. I remember playing Brian Lara cricket would have been the Mega Drive back then. I think the Sega Mega Drive. So yeah, I'm probably showing my age a little bit, but that was. That was a pretty important game in my life in the mid-90s, I would say.
Which one was that, Daryl? Was that 96?
No, the both. There was one before that. I think Brian Lara Cricket 96 was the second version. So, yeah, obviously that would have been around 1996, I'd imagine. But but the one previous to that, probably, yeah, probably 93, 94, I guess. I'd have been around 10 or 11, something like that.
Jeez.
Have you played any of the like more recent cricket games?
No, since becoming a cricketer, I think it becomes a little bit more of a busman's holiday. I'm more of a FIFA man or a Call of Duty man at the moment, yeah. I suppose. But Jack Chantrey actually used to play that international cricket captain on the bus trip, which I think he got a lot of stick for, and rightly so. So yeah, I didn't always make his team either. So he got a bit of stick for that when he left me out of his side when we were on a trip to Old Trafford or Henley or somewhere. So not cricket games, not for me now.
Can't be a bit of FIFA.
Yeah, although when I try and play with Villa, it's bloody hard work because obviously there's a severe lack of numbers in skill level in some of the squads. So yeah, I probably have to venture away from Villa, unfortunately, and use a Man City or a Liverpool probably more often than not.
Fair enough. And we'll come on to that a little bit more in depth a bit later in the teammate section. But let's chat a little bit about yourself as a cricketer now, Darryl. So how would you describe yourself as a cricketer and sort of like the roles, I guess, that you play?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've evolved a lot over the years. I think going right back to the very start of my professional career, I was a very nuggety, boring opening batter who batted long periods of time and strike rates were relatively low, I would say, and just tried to occupy the crease as much as I could. I think I've evolved as I've gone along and tried to, first of all, try and force myself into the white ball teams as sort of a bit of an all-rounder, developed my bowling a little bit and came into that side as sort of number six or seven. In T20, again, obviously the game's moved on a lot, hasn't it? I think going back from when it first started, sort of 140, 50, 150 was par. Now, if you don't get 180, you're probably going to lose. So, again, sort of expanding my game to try and keep up with the trends, I guess. And again, try and fiddle away with some overs in the middle in that format as well. And I think that's probably helped my Red Bull cricket as well. I think I'm more expansive now than I ever was in my early days, even in Red Bull cricket. And I guess the strike rates and the pace that I score my runs has definitely improved over the years.
It's interesting to hear that.
Yeah, I guess that shows in a good way like the evolution of white ball cricket and the fact that it can have, because many people think that, well, not many people, but some people think that, you know, it sort of had a negative effect on red ball cricket as well. But I guess there you've kind of proved people wrong in saying that it's also helped your red ball game come along as well, which is obviously good to hear. And obviously now you're a pretty crucial member of the Worcestershire white ball sides as well.
Yeah, I think from one of my strengths as a cricket, I don't see myself as particularly a talented player. I don't think anyone would ever have said that. I've just sort of been able to find a way and tried to find a niche, if you like, to A, stay in the team and be part of the team and then be successful when I'm there. So obviously I've performed very different roles in the formats, obviously opening the batting in Red Bull, 50 over cricket. I have batted at the top of the order, but spent a lot of my time at sort of four or five playing spin in those middle overs and bowling a little bit. And then T20, I've almost done everything really just to try and find a slot in the team, batted from anywhere from probably 10 to 1 and gone full circle really now, sort of more in the team as a bowler, really batting at that 8-9 over the last couple of years and trying to mix it up and mix my pace and be as accurate as I possibly can be in those sort of middle overs with the ball, more so than be effective with the bat.
Well, yeah, that's very interesting to hear then, purely because you've played all sorts of different roles. Usually you have a set role in a team.
Yeah.
You're either an opening batsman, you're an all-rounder, and yet you seem to be a jack-of-all-trades. Have you actually enjoyed that in your career, Darryl, or do you wish that you, I don't know, maybe would have carved out a more stable role in a team?
No, I've enjoyed it, definitely. I think my Red Bull role has been very consistent, really. I mean, I suppose initially I was on the fringe. I sort of filled gaps when players were injured or lost form and stuff. But sort of from probably 2007 onwards, I batted nowhere other than at the top of the order. So that's remained consistent. I see that as my bread and butter, if you like, in terms of my career. The white ball stuff, it's almost filling the needs of the team. And I have enjoyed different roles. I don't particularly, if I'm being brutally honest, I don't particularly like batting at 8 and 9. I still see myself as a batter or a genuine all-rounder at least in T20 cricket. But the way our team has evolved and the players you've got, and they've all earned the right to probably bat in front of me, if I'm brutally honest as well. So it is the right role to fill. But yeah, it is something I've enjoyed. And like I say, just trying to fill the needs of the voids of the team wherever I can and do the best to try and get results for Worcester.
Fair enough.
So let's go a little bit sort of back in time, if you like, now to more of your youth again. Did you always sort of envision yourself becoming a professional cricketer, or was that always like your dream job, or was there something else you wanted to do? And if you hadn't have become a professional, what would you have done instead?
Yeah, it was always football and cricket as a kid. I mean, I loved all sports really. I count trials at rugby and hockey as well, and played a bit of darts and stuff like that. But football and cricket were the main two. I was at Villa for, I think, 3 years, from about 10 to 13, something like that. And the reality was, at Villa, I was probably in the bottom five or six of a 30 strong group of at my age group. Whereas cricket, I was probably in the top three of my age group in terms of performances in that field. So I was a better cricketer than I was a footballer. That was how I worked out. When I got released by Villa, I had three or four options of trials at various clubs, but decided that no, that's not probably the way I should go, and focus more on being a cricketer. And from then on, that was the sort of goal, was to be cricket first above everything else. And I did have plans, as backup plans, if it didn't work out, in terms of I got a degree and PE teaching was going to be my sort of fallback, and if cricket didn't work out. But the goal was to play cricket, and it's something that I've obviously loved for a long, long time, and been very fortunate enough to have a relatively long career at it.
Yeah, in that little phrase, I did just want to mention something. You mentioned darts there, Daryl. If you had to have a nickname in darts, what would you go for?
Oh, I did have a set of flights with Dazzler on when I was a kid, playing in the pub at probably 16, 17. So, yeah, probably I'd have to go back to my roots and go with that, probably.
I think that's a good... I rate that. It fits, like... It's not, like, too dissimilar from your name, I guess, in a way.
Yeah, I think that was it, yeah. I remember the white flights with gold letters, Dazzler, bespoke made, and in the void of not being able to think of anything else and just being put on the spot like this, I'd probably have to go with that again, I think.
No, fair enough. It does work. That's actually quite a good one. But bringing the conversation back onto cricket then, let's talk about your early days at Worcestershire then, because, of course, you've had a long and illustrious career down at New Road. So, Daryl, what do you remember from your Worcestershire County Championship debut?
It was down at Bath against Somerset. It was an interesting one, because I remember I was 12th man originally for that game, and Gareth Batty, I think it was, got called up for an England one-day squad. So he ended up leaving halfway through the game. I think he might have been not out overnight, actually. And I remember he knew he was going, and he was swinging as hard as he could to try and smash a few runs quickly. And I was sort of praying, sat there watching his 12-man, praying he wouldn't get out so I could go out and have a bat first thing in the morning, which he did. I think he was probably, I don't know, 15 or 16, not out, something overnight. And I basically rocked up on, I think it might have been day three, and just rocked up, went out to have a bat, having not fielded a ball in the game at that point. LBW Caddick 4, I think it was my first innings in Championship cricket.
I've got a bit of a stunned expression, because that's incredible recall from 15 years ago.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I mean, obviously you don't forget your first class or your county championship debut, I guess. So yeah, obviously dad came down with my sister to watch, and yeah, I remember it really well. I mean, we knocked the runs off in the second innings. I didn't have to bat second innings. So,
was it a boundary that you hit, or was it just...
No, I think it's probably three. Judge actually probably goes in tone with the rest of my career. It's probably four singles down to third man and final leg, I thought.
Let's just touch upon that as well. We mentioned strike rate earlier. 4 from 25.
Yeah, exactly what I talked about. Yeah, we'll take that.
Yeah, fantastic recall. I mean, you'd be surprised. Some players don't remember the debut, even if it's about 3 or 4 years ago. So, again, incredible. Worcestershire won by 8 wickets. Andy Caddick as well.
I think in those initial sort of 3 or 4 years of my career, he got me out 6 or 7 times, I think. At one point, he was certainly the man who got me out more than anybody else in first-class cricket. And then I think Monty Panesar overtook him a little bit later on. But, yeah, fantastic bowler. Obviously, by that point, he was probably... Well, he was tail end of his career, having finished with England and stuff, but shape, bounce, he's probably a yard slower than he was at his peak, I'd have thought. But yeah, he's still a fine, fine bowler, and caused me plenty of problems, that for sure.
Well, there's no shame in that. Was it 2000 at Headingley? He knocked over the West Indies for like 61. He got 4 wickets in an over.
Yeah, I remember watching that on TV, actually. Yeah, no, he was obviously, him and Gough formed a pretty formidable partnership during that era, didn't they? They were two fantastic new ball bowlers, and both with great records at the top level.
Yeah. So, obviously, a few years later, you've been playing in the county championship for about 5 years by this point. So, in 2010, you become the captain of your home county after years of dedication and hard work. I just wanted to know, how momentous of an occasion was that for you, Percy Darrell?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, obviously, I guess that period, having not played for England, that period as captain in my home country was probably the sort of pinnacle of my career, really, and the highest level of achievement I got. So yeah, it was a huge moment. I think actually when I became captain, it was a bit bittersweet at the time because Vikram Solanki stood down as captain at Colwyn Bay after a 4-day defeat against Glamorgan, I think it was. So yeah, that was quite a sad moment because Vic was somebody who probably got more respect for Vic in cricket than anybody else, actually. He was a real sort of big influence on me, on my career, and he was obviously my captain for a long time, gave me opportunities, so something I would all be grateful to. So him actually stepping down was a real sad moment for the whole squad. But obviously off the back of that, I became sort of captain to the end of the season initially, and it was a huge honour. I remember walking out Surrey first game. The pride I felt was immense, really, and to get a win in my first game. I think we went on to win sort of 4 or 5 out of the last 6 and get promoted actually in that year. So yeah, it was a great start and something that I look back on fondly, albeit I suppose the initial element of sadness at the start of it with Vic stepping down.
Yeah, we mentioned Vikram Solanki there, Daryl, and of course it seems though you have an immense deal of respect for him. You mentioned that he gave you an opportunity as a young player. So I just wanted to know, as a captain yourself, and of course having been mentored by Vikram Solanki, what do you think makes a great captain in the world of cricket?
I think any leader, actually. I think consistency is important. So I think, and that sort of cool calmness under pressure, when the proverbial hits the fan, I think players look to you and to show that you're in control, even though if you're not necessarily underneath. I think showing that from the outside, I think is important. Honesty, being straight talking with the players. And I guess, yeah, and obviously there's an element of having a sort of tactical understanding of the game, particularly in cricket, probably more so than any other sport, having that understanding and ability to read the game and execute your plans in any given situation is a really important skill as well.
And just, again, on captains, who would you say, either international cricket or on the county circuit, who would you say are some of the best captains you look at now? I mean, for me, the likes of Owen Morgan springs to mind, but you know, maybe you have other ideas.
Yeah, I think Morgan is obviously a World Cup winner. I think sort of speaks for itself, but the way that he's sort of transformed that team, the way he's in control, I think the respect he's got from his players, and there's some big personalities in that dressing room, some obviously world-class players amongst it as well. And I think they all look to Morgan to lead them. So I think he's probably the best in the world, if I'm being brutally honest. I think aside from that, Moeen Ali has had a similar sort of galvanising effect and impact on our T20 side. I think probably goes in about a different, very quiet mode, very calm, relaxed. But I think the influence he has, particularly on our young players, is huge off the field, tactically very astute as well. So I think Mo's probably the best captain I've played under, I would say. And the way he goes about it is very different to some others, very relaxed. And he brings the best out of players and breeds confidence within the group, certainly. So I think Mo would be very good, actually, and obviously good to see him get an opportunity to captain an England side during that sort of lockdown behind closed door period, I think it was, wasn't it? So yeah, he's a brilliant leader as well.
I feel like that comes across a lot as well with Mo, like you say, like he seems quite calm and relaxed, especially on TV. You can obviously see that more, and I feel like that definitely comes across. Yeah, Aaron, who would you say yours is
of all time or at the moment?
Oh, at the moment,
obviously Owen Morgan, great choice. Yeah. But Kane Williamson, captain, cool.
Yeah.
Magnificent captain, magnificent batsman as well. Beautiful to watch as a fan. Yeah. But of course, we mentioned level-headedness there with Moeen Ali. I think Kane Williamson is almost the personification of that. And he's a fantastic captain. I mean, obviously New Zealand, desperately unlucky not to have won that World Cup. I know he played for your favourite county as well, Joe, Yorkshire. Yeah, great captain, Kane Williamson, and someone who I've always had great respect for as a batsman and as a captain.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I feel like Josh Butler's done really, really well as well when he's had the opportunity to captain England.
Who do you support again, Joe?
Well, I'm being serious. Similar to Mo, obviously, he had the opportunity to captain England. I feel like Joss as well. You know, when he's had the opportunity to, I feel like he's done a good job. Obviously, before the World Cup, he had a couple of chances when, obviously, Morgan sat out a few games. So, yeah, I feel like Joss has done well as well. But, yeah. So, let's chat, Daryl, a little bit then about your Worcestershire career. And as a whole thing, what would you say your favourite moment is in a pair shirt?
I think winning the T20 at Edgbaston, when was it? What year are we in now? 2018, it would have been, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
2018. Yeah, I mean, that was, I think obviously we had a lot of promotions, won Division 2. I think I won the Pro 40 in 2007, which was special. But I think that day, finals day, it was the first time I'd been to finals day, first time we'd made it over 15 years. Yeah, to win the final there in front of the that crowd at finals day is phenomenal, really. One of the biggest buzzes you'll ever get on as a cricketer on a field. So, yeah, to win that was a special day and a special moment, certainly.
Unfortunately, you didn't knock Lanx out there in the semis. Yeah, that was a frustrating day for me.
That was a couple of good games that day, actually. I think we probably won by 10 or 15. Brownie, if I remember, got 4 for at the end and swung the game our way against the Lanx. And then I thought we were relatively, as you can be in the final, relatively in control against Sussex. And then obviously Coxey sort of finished off very quickly off that Jofra Archer over to get us over the line with an over and a bit to spare. But I think actually last year, 2019's games were more exciting. I think we won by one run off the last ball against Notts, where they, let's be honest, there's a bit of a choke going on there. They probably should have won that. And then we were probably ahead of the game against Essex and probably could have felt like we were in control. And then Ravi and Simon Harmer took it away at the end and we lost off the last ball in that one. So two magnificent games of cricket. And obviously that hurt not winning that. But looking back, that was a brilliant experience to be part of the losing finals day as well as the winning one, to be honest.
Yeah, but I always feel like losing a semi-final hurts more than a final. I don't know. What do you think, Darryl, from a player's point of view?
Yeah, I tend to. We did lose the semi-final in the 50 over. We lost a lot of quarterfinals and not getting to finals there. That was frustrating. Obviously, as a club, never have been there to lose a lot of the quarterfinals. I think I lost something like 8 knockout games in a row, either quarterfinals or semi-finals, before we eventually got to finals day. So, yeah, that's disappointing. To be part of the final is great. But I think once you're there, you want to win it, don't you? And over the line. But finals day in particular is a brilliant day to be a part of, and to get to play 2 games is certainly. We haven't lost in the semi-final there, but I think it was great to be a part of that second final despite losing it, unfortunately.
Yeah, fair enough. And also a shout out to Jack Davis, who also asked a fan question, which was, what was it like being part of both 2018 and 2019 finals day? So obviously that question has been answered here. So yeah, thanks Jack for your question. And also before we move on to the next question, I would actually like to ask a little bit about that Moeen Ali innings against Sussex in the quarterfinal last year. That was absolutely outrageous on telly. What was that like being there and seeing it live?
Well, I'd like to be able to tell you what it was like live, but I watched the whole inning, sat camped in the dressing room at Hove. I watched it on the telly. So I didn't. I don't think I actually saw a ball. I saw the odd ball that flashed past the window going out of the ground. But other than that, I pretty much watched it on TV. I tend to, not used to being batting so far down the order, I tend to camp myself away and hide a little bit during 2020 run chases in particular. So I'm not a great watcher. So I don't like to show my what's going on in my mind in front of all the other lads who are waiting to bat. So I sort of parked myself away. I remember watching the majority of innings with our bowling coach, Alan Richardson, in the dressing room, which was, I mean, it was amazing, wasn't it? I mean, obviously, there was that chance earlier that I think, is it Carey, the Aussie? Yeah, and obviously he's a world cap, very good cricket, international standard keeper, and I think he would have caught that probably 990 times out of 1,000. And then to go on to, I mean, after that though, it was just phenomenal, wasn't it? 6 after 6, yep. And you could hear even from the dressing room, you could hear the Hove crowd getting quieter and quieter as it went along, and phenomenal. But he's capable of that. He's played other innings similar to that, and not necessarily on TV, but as a white ball opening or top 3 batter, he is a phenomenal cricketer in his own right. Forget his bowling and his captaincy ability. His out and out batting at the top of the order is phenomenal. And he saved some of his best performances for Warwickshire, actually, which is always a nice thing, being a local derby. He's got a couple of hundreds at Edgbaston when we really needed him. And he's a man for the big occasion, Mo. And like you say, that cool, calm nature of his probably helps him out in those situations.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I've witnessed some of those firsthand. And Darryl, we have to talk about this. What does the Bears versus Pears derby mean to you? Obviously, I'm a massive Warwickshire fan. It's the game that every single year when the fixture list comes out, goes straight into the calendar. What does it mean to you personally?
Yeah, it's, again, first one you look for. That and maybe if you've got an opportunity to play at Lords, I think they're the two things that you look for on a fixture list, and probably the only things I look for on a fixture list, actually. So, yeah, those particularly at Edgbaston, actually. I mean, Worcester New Road's always bouncing, but no lights. It's a sort of a 5:30 kickoff, and it's probably not quite got the atmosphere of the Eric Hollis under lights. So I think those T20s at Edgbaston are special games, certainly. And I think we've got a reasonable record. We probably do better away from home than we have at home, actually, I would suggest, from memory. But we've got a reasonable record, certainly, in recent years down there. And, yeah, it's a big rivalry. I think it's a friendly rivalry amongst the players, I would say. There's no animosity there really amongst the players, but it's certainly, when the crowd get going, there's certainly, obviously you get a decent travelling support from Worcestershire supporters, seems to be a chunk, particularly from the Black Country, Stourbridge, that kind of area that tend to be very vocal in the area, Collis. And the, yeah, it's a good atmosphere, good banter. And yeah, it's important to try and get over the line for those supporters as much as yourselves. And obviously the points are important as well in any given competition.
Yeah, definitely. A lovely way of putting it. And that's the thing. I don't think it's to the level of the Roses derby in terms of animosity between either players or fans. But at the same time, as you mentioned, for Worcestershire fans as well, big day out. You get to go to a proper test venue instead of going down to the little county ground down the road. So, yeah, it must be quite nice, I think.
Yeah, like I say, it's great to go there. And obviously, more often than not, we've managed to quieten down the local Brummies. It's a great taste to have a beer there after coming away with a victory.
Apart from this year, of course.
Apart from this year, yeah. There was nobody there to see it. It's probably obviously less important this year than ever before, isn't it?
And as a man who has played at both Old Trafford and Edgbaston, Daryl, could you be maybe one to settle a debate of which has the best T20 atmosphere? Because this is quite an ongoing debate.
It's comparing apples and pears, really, I think. Because obviously, probably for Lancashire supporters, the gate against Worcester probably would be one of the lower ones, I'd have thought. Obviously, it's from the distance that travel is very little away support, and yeah, it's far from full. Whereas obviously Edgbaston, we tend to get somewhere between 15,000 and 20,000 for a pairs bears game. So it's difficult to compare the two. I've never been to Old Trafford on a Roses match. That looks pretty special on TV, certainly. So, but from my experience, obviously the pairs bears game is huge, and that the atmosphere there is almost on a par with finals day, actually, in a lot of ways.
I'd agree. Fair enough. Last year in particular, 19,000 turned up, and we were pretty much eliminated by that point. And of course, Mo and Ali again absolutely dispatched us with both bat and ball again. But a brilliant atmosphere. And as you said, it is, for me personally, you mentioned finals day, it's also probably the closest we get to an international cricket atmosphere as well. Just incredible.
Yeah, it's been long standing as well. I remember I think my first game was at Edgbaston was 2005. Heath Streak and Nick Knight were playing for Warwickshire. That's how old I was. And we won by one run. But that, I think that was over 19,000 that night as well. And that's, again, that was, I think that's probably only my second or third T20 match. And that was something that sticks in the memory as well, the atmosphere there. And I fielded right in front of the area, Collis, and copped it for the whole of the sort of 20 over, or sorry, probably 16 overs after the power play. Yeah, entertaining evening. I'd heard words that I'd never heard before at a young, tender age of 20 or whatever. So.
Fair enough. So, Darren, let's chat now a little bit about, again, your Worcestershire career. What would you say the toughest moment you've had in a Worcestershire has been up to now?
Oh, God. There's been a lot of losses and relegations. Yeah, obviously, you've been, I suppose, the ultimate yo-yo club, I'd imagine, across the country. I think I've been promoted 6 times and obviously relegated 6 times as well, or something along those lines. So, yeah. They're always tough to take, and I thought I sort of alluded to earlier, really, those quarterfinals, semi-finals that we've not quite got to, that sort of road to get into that first finals day. They were some tough moments, having losing those games as well. They were difficult to take as well.
Where do you rank this year in terms of tough moments, though? Because obviously we've had all the uncertainty about the season even starting, and then of course playing in front of no crowds. How tough was that for you personally?
I think Red Bull cricket, it wasn't too much of an issue. Obviously that was at the start. I think majority of players were just so glad to get out there and get back training and get back playing. I think for me, Red Bull cricket, the beauty of Red Bull cricket is a real test of skill against your opposition number. So bat versus ball. Yeah, like I say, you're getting a war of attrition with the bloke at the other end, and what goes around that doesn't matter too much in my opinion. I think T20 cricket, it was really different. I think T20 cricket for me is all about the sort of razzmatazz that goes with it, the music, the fireworks, and the energy and atmosphere that's created by the crowd. And that missing, that really did feel like almost like practice games, really, and warm-up games. I think it was difficult to create that sort of energy and excitement that you get and you feed off the crowd, I would say.
Yeah, I think a lot of the guests that we've had on have kind of said the same thing in a way that, you know, Red Bull cricket it's been different, of course, but the atmosphere that you would get at maybe a test match, which is of course Red Bull cricket, is not the same as you would get at a county championship match, which is disappointing to see, for sure. But yeah, I think a lot of the guests have said the same thing, really.
Yeah, I think the TV game was a little bit better. We played Somerset at Edgbaston. That obviously you've got there's a bit of a buzz with people running around with cameras and stuff and commentators, and they put on a bit. There was music in the stands and stuff, and there was the fire things that come out and that kind of stuff. So it sort of added to a little bit of more normality than the other games. But a lot of the games, sort of, we played a lot in the afternoon as well, which seemed a bit different as well. Sort of, yeah, like 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock starts, compared to the 5:30s or the 6:30s that you get on the lights.
I just have to ask this: what's your favourite T20 Blast song?
Oh, I think it's got to be Sweet Caroline at Finals Day. I think,
yeah, you can't get on with that. You can't
get past that. I don't think. I think it's just when the whole crowd starts singing it. That's
And then the music stops in between, like, as the ball is being bowled, and the crowd just carry on singing anyway. May as well just leave the music on the grass.
On, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There are some shockers though knocking around as well, but particularly the sort of team songs that seem to change every year. There's some things I've never heard before and don't wish to hear again, that is for sure. As included, actually, Worcester's ones, some of them are terrible.
Our one's incredible. This Girl by Kungs versus, what is it, Three Burners or something?
I'm trying to think what ours is. I can't even think off the top of my head.
Tell you what yours used to be, Morning Glory by Oasis. I remember that at Edgbaston.
No, I'm trying to think of Old Trafford, but it's been. It's been that long since I've been to Old Trafford, hasn't it? Well, I mean, everyone. It's been so long since any fan's been in.
Surely it's Oasis. They must have kept it.
I don't know.
They had Morning Glory, 100%.
You know what? It's totally gone out of my mind. What about when you win, Darryl? Do you have a song?
Yeah, we've got a team song. I think we actually, it originated from Perth. Tom Mooney was our coach at the time. We were affiliated with a club called Midland Guildford. So we basically, I played there. Stephen Moore played there, Vikram played there, Cabby Rowdy played there, probably Chris Liptrot, I think, played there. And obviously Tom, Matt Mason was another one who came from there originally. So yeah, we basically swiped their song and replaced the word Midland for Worcester. So the Worcester boys are happy rather than the Midland boys are happy. So that's where it came from. And that's probably been in place probably 15 years now, I reckon.
Well, easy thing to do that, I guess, then. Just saves you, you know, thinking of a song and stuff. Having to rewrite lyrics, maybe, but yeah.
By the way, the worst on the circuit is definitely the Lancashire one, in terms of when they've beat us quite a lot over the years. It's basically just the darts theme. She's the
I rate that one.
That's a great one. Chase the Sun by Planet Funk. What a song.
Definitely the worst.
When we won the quarterfinal against Sussex, they put a video out on Twitter, which was good. And, well, I assume the changing rooms was somewhere in, like, the indoor school, because that's where all the... like, everyone was at the end of the game in the video, and everyone had, like, the bats against the floor, like banging them against the floor to the tune. I think we've got a good one.
Honking, terrible.
Worst. I think we've got
definitely
a good one.
The worst.
So let's chat a little bit then about Worcestershire's summer then. How would you sum up, you know, your summer as a team?
Yeah, mixed. I mean, obviously, Red Bull, I thought there was some real positives. I thought we batted unbelievably well as a group. We came up against a very, very good Somerset team in the last game of the Bob Willis Trophy group stages, and basically a winner takes all in terms of getting to the final. And unfortunately, we came up just short. Fought so many positives and so many great performances to speak of in that. So that was really positive. And then the T20 was obviously bitterly disappointing. Obviously, I've had the success of 18 and 19. Two finals, and we just never got going, really didn't get any momentum, and we were missing some big players. I think certainly the first part, I think we were sort of four out from our best side. Obviously we normally see Moen for probably about half the games. He didn't play at all. Brownie was in the England bubble initially, so we didn't have him to start with. Wayne Parnell, been a big part of our side actually in terms of death bowling in particular, was a huge miss, having not come over from South Africa. And we only had the one overseas, and we've obviously had two top order batters in recent times in Guptill and Rutherford and Ferguson, two out of the three normally over the recent period, and we only had one of those. So there's a few holes that with a small club like ourselves, it's sort of difficult to plug those gaps. And unfortunately, like, yeah, I think we still probably should have won more games than we did. I think we got in positions to win games and didn't get quite over the line, but yeah, disappointing all in all not to have more of an impact on that competition.
Yeah, I think that is fair enough. I think in terms of the Red Bull, though, I think that's fantastic when you think compared to last year. And then to really compete in the central group, I thought was fantastic.
Yeah, I think we were second bottom. We were certainly down there. I think we underachieved last year. I don't think that's probably a fair reflection of where we should be. So it's probably not quite as big a jump as you expect. But I think, obviously, traditionally, we've been sort of that mid-table team, promoted and relegated somewhere between sort of 9th and 12th has probably been our sort of spot over the last 15 years in reality. So, but I think this year, certainly there were signs of huge improvement. And one of our goals is certainly to get, if the divisional structure does come back, to be that sort of top six team, to try and push into that sort of top tier and be sustainable in that top tier of 4-day game.
Fair enough, some big goals there. Let's move on, I suppose, from professional cricket then. And let's talk about the Professional Cricketers Association, Darryl, because this is another huge role that you've played in county cricket. And I think in a way, you've almost gone under the radar for a lot of cricket fans. Like, your role has been absolutely huge, in particular this season. First of all, how did that role come about? How did you first get into the PCA?
So it was just after I finished as captain, actually. There was Mark Wallace finished his four-year term, or two-year term. So the association were after a new chairman. I sort of put my name in the hat with five others, I think it was, and really honoured to be elected as the PCA chairman at that point. What would it be, 3.5 years ago or something now? So, yeah, that was it. Obviously, it was a huge honour. I probably didn't quite realise how big a role it was at the time, but I think my tenure has been interesting, to say the least. Obviously, there's been big negotiation around the county partnership agreement, the new standard contract, the advent of the 100 and the uproar around that. And then obviously sort of guiding the organisation and professional cricket, I guess, through the COVID period over the last sort of 6 months or whatever it's been, has been, yeah, testing to say the least at times, but also very, very rewarding and very satisfying at times when you do get things over the line.
Yeah, I think, as you say, it certainly sounds like a big job. It isn't something that I feel should be taken lightly as a professional cricketer, like a decision that should be just taken lightly. So, yeah, I mean, from a fan's point of view, you've done a really, really good job. And as Aaron said, you know, I think you sort of go, your role sort of goes under the radar a little bit. But what would you say the most challenging part of the job is? Because, I mean, we've kind of mentioned it a little bit. It is a tricky job. What would you say the biggest challenges that you faced have been so far?
Well, I guess the stuff that I've just mentioned, all the negotiations and stuff around the various things, contracts, 100, CPA, but you're actually fighting for the positive a lot there. So there's not too many negatives to come out of that. You're just trying to get what's deserved and what you feel is right and fair for from the player's point of view. Whereas I think the most difficult thing, without a doubt, has been the COVID situation. And you're talking about people's livelihoods, people losing jobs, losing contracts, people within the organisation, actually not cricketers, whose jobs are under threat, pay cuts across the board within the PCA, trying to convince the player reps, the players committee, that taking pay cuts through this summer period is the right course of action, the right course of thing, right thing to do for the game in helping to save non-cricket and cricket jobs further down the line and trying to keep counties afloat effectively during this period, because obviously it's been a financial strain on all counties. It's been extremely difficult. So when you're negotiating around and talking about things like people's livelihoods, that certainly added pressure that I hadn't really experienced before, and certainly created a few sleepless nights at times. But I think we've generally handled things well as a player group and as a PCA throughout this pandemic, and I think the game actually has been seen in pretty good light. I think the ECB, the counties, the players have all kept together, stuck together with a common goal of getting cricket in its best possible position as it can be come once we get through this pandemic. And I think compared to other sports, I think we've managed to guide the game fairly well through it to this point, without the animosity and the fallout that perhaps we've seen in rugby and football and other sports. So yeah, it's been challenging, but like I say, pretty satisfying at times as well.
Yeah. And as myself and Joe said, we think you've done a great job. Of course, it's been, well, the most challenging period, I suppose, for any PCA chairman. Mm. It's not often a pandemic pops up, is it, during a cricket season?
No, absolutely. I mean, I think from the whole sort of start of my tenure, really, I think I sort of sum it up as probably the worst time to be involved as chairman of the PCA in terms of a time management point of view and everything that's been thrown at us. But from almost the opposite, from an experience point of view, it's been phenomenal, really. And the experience I've gained over the course of this sort of, well, what will be 4 years when my term ends in February, is invaluable to me moving forward, and probably shaped my life post cricketing career as well. So I need to be thankful for that. And it's been a wonderful experience with a great organisation.
Definitely. And of course, yep, we have our banter, Bears versus Pairs, but I must admit, Darryl, I do respect what you've done. I really do. Of course, rivalries aside, I think the county game, of course, it's not in the place in which we wanted it to be, obviously, but that's the pandemic. I think the way in which cricket has handled it has been fantastic.
Yeah, I agree. And I think a lot of, obviously, we have our differences with the ECB and the counties, obviously, at times, but I think the way the ECB have handled the whole situation has been pretty good. And to put on the amount of international cricket they did this summer was in the biosecure bubble was phenomenal, really. And the amount of work and effort and cost that went into that actually was phenomenal. But what it did was save our game in a lot of ways in terms of creating the broadcast to get those broadcast revenues in, which obviously filters down to the counties and will stand the care domestic game in good stead as well as the international moving forward.
Yep, and fingers crossed we can return to some normality sometime
soon.
That would be good. But you have mentioned there the ECB. Now, we're not going to go into too much detail because, of course, it's a massive controversial topic, the 100. You're either for it, you're against it. I mean, there's an entire Twitter group which is opposed to the 100. So, Daryl, I'm not going to obviously go into too much depth here, but as a result of the 100, there is going to be a consequence of 50-over cricket. And, of course, when we were talking earlier about Owen Morgan, Moeen Ali, World Cup winners, we've just won the 50-over World Cup. I just wanted to know your thoughts on the future of 50-over cricket in England. What do you think the future of the Royal London One Day Cup holds?
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult one. I think, obviously, with the schedule, there's something that has to give, and 50-over cricket is the competition, I guess, they've decided that is downgraded is probably the wrong word, but in terms of a sort of development competition and not involve the top 96 or whatever domestic players that are going to be involved in the 100. So I think it's a shame. I think 50-over cricket is a great format, and obviously, like you said, we're World Cup winners, so that I don't really know what the alternatives were with the 100 voted through and put in place, though, to be perfectly honest. So I think it'll give great opportunity to some younger players to get that sort of bridge that gap between second team cricket and first team cricket, certainly. And I know certainly I think we're losing 7 or 8 if it's the same as the first draft from Worcester. So it'll give opportunities to young guys like Jack Haynes and Adam Finch and people like that to really sort of stamp their authority on first team cricket during that period. And then hopefully push for places in the four-day team and the T20 team as well off the back of that.
Yeah, it's interesting that, because obviously we've seen a lot of younger players having an opportunity. Obviously, there's been not many overseas players. Obviously, you guys at Worcester have had one. But yeah, most counties haven't really had an overseas this year. So we've seen a lot of youngsters getting a go, and people away in international bubbles from a lot more counties than what we've been used to, because as the bubbles have been bigger. So yeah, we've seen a lot more, you know, youngsters coming through. And I guess one of the positives from that is that, you know, you're going to see youngsters getting a chance. And it's still going to be high standard of cricket, because I say there's only like 96, 100 people who've been selected from the domestic game to go and play in the 100. So you're still going to have a good standard of cricket. And it is a shame in a way that, you know, there won't be any.
I agree.
The top 100 players, if you like. But yeah, there'll definitely be a...
Yeah, I think you've seen the positives this year. I mean, like, if Somerset, for example, had been at full strength, would Tom Lamonby got the opportunities that he got? And obviously, he was a standout performer in that competition. I think with Colpax and overseas in their squad, and without as many as they did in the bubble, would he have got his opportunity to show what he can do? So I think there has been some positives out of the negative situation we're in, certainly.
Yeah, and positives as well for the future for England, because Tom Lamonby may not have played this year, may not have broke through, and for me, one day looks a good prospect to play for England. So, you know, when that will be, who knows? So, yeah, I guess there's a silver lining in every situation, no matter how strange it has been this year. Let's chat then, the final question. Let's chat a little bit about that. What have you got plans, or have you got any even, for after you retire from professional cricket?
Yeah, so I did my coaching badges originally, level 3, and that was sort of the original plan, I guess, until the sort of PCA role cropped up, really. So I think what that has given me is a thirst to stay in cricket, certainly in some sort of administrative capacity, whether that's commercial or operations or whatever, that I'm not sure yet. But certainly I think sports administration is something that really appeals to me, and I've really enjoyed the role at the PCA, and something along those sort of lines moving forward out of cricket is something that I'm hoping to do in the next stage, if you like. In my obviously, you're a long time retired from cricket, there's a lot of working years ahead of me. So just if I could possibly stay in sport in particular, not necessarily just cricket, but sport in particular in a administration role, then that's something that, that excites me and something that I'd like to do, certainly.
Well, Daryl, we wish you the very best of luck with that, of course, and of course with the remainder of your playing years at Worcestershire.
Without doubt.
Still got a few years left, hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully. I'm obviously contracted for this year, so we'll see what happens. Hopefully try and get plenty of runs and earn another one, I guess.
Fingers fair crossed. Enough. But yeah, we wish you the very best of luck with your future endeavours as well.
Thank you very much.
So let's move on then to some fan questions. Obviously, we've already answered one, which was from Jack, about the finals days that you've played in. So the next one is from Mitch, and he's asking, what are your top three innings for Worcestershire in all formats?
Wow. I'll have a couple of Red Bull ones first, if that's all right. So my best innings was probably 138, I think it was, not out at Trent Bridge, 2017. I think it was a relatively low scoring game on a green pitch. I think we were chasing about 250 or something like that. So to get us over the line second innings, that was important. And we went on to obviously won the game and then went on to win the division that year. Pippin Knotts, who finished second. So it was an important game and probably as well as I've played, actually, I think, over the course of my career. So I think that's my favourite innings, A, for the cricket and the innings, but also for what it meant and where it took us for the remaining two games of the season in winning the division. Second, I've probably got to choose. I've got 298, obviously my highest score at Taunton, 2009. So I think that's probably got to be in the top three for obvious reasons. And then one white ball one, I think, was against Lancashire. We were something like 100 for five, chasing 250, and I got 100 odd not out, and we won the game the last over. So I think that would be up there.
Fair enough. Just a shame that was against Lancs, to be honest. But
yeah, apologies for that.
It's all right. And then the third question is from Owen Morris, and he's asked, who is the best overseas player you've ever played with at Worcestershire? And this is a really, really good question for me.
That is tough. I think early, obviously, from a names point of view, my first overseas players I played with were Chris Gayle and Shoaib Akhtar. So obviously, this is pre-IPL, in terms of high profile, we had those two and Chaminda Vass that year in 2005. So they were obviously really high profile names and stuff. But in terms of contribution, Syed Ajmal was unbelievable. Obviously, cloud around his technique, I guess, if you like, in terms of but what he did, even if he did chuck it, nobody else could do it to chuck it that well. So he was a genius to stand at slip to, and the way he performed was phenomenal. And Zaheer Khan was another, actually, in terms of he got 70 odd wickets in 2007, I think. And just Zaheer was special in that he could bowl so many different ways. If it was swinging, he could swing it back and get people LBW. If it was a green pitch, he'd just lob it on a length and seam it both ways. But then if you got on a flat one, he could run in reverse swing and bowl genuinely fast as well. So he was a genuine all-rounder within a bowling capacity, if that makes sense. He could do anything. So he was extremely talented as well. So yeah, I think I'd go those two. And even though I'm a batter, I think those two actually probably won us or got us promotion, certainly, in those 2 years that they were around. Syed did a couple of years, but the 1 year in particular, he almost got his... You knew as a batting group, if you set somebody 200 in the last day, that you were going to win, because he just bowled them out for fun, got 70 wickets in 9 games or something. So I think those two are probably the ones I go for.
In the nets then, and we'll include Chaminda Vass and Shoaib Akhtar as well, who would you least like to face?
Oh, God. I actually go Simon Jones, I think. Again, he almost like effortless run up, and he could at times he bowled rockets, and new road nets are not the flattest, and they can go up and down a little bit, particularly when they're a little bit tired. So yeah, he was awful to face, and he skillful swing seam, and it'd be very rare that you get through a net session without one in the inner thigh or the groin area at some point off Jonesy, as well as in he's naturally an aggressive guy, an aggressive bowler, so even the nets he'd still just let you have it around your head and bounce you as well. So he was always a tough one that you looked at the board or who you were facing in the nets and stuff. He was one you desperately were trying to hope was bowling at somebody else and not you, that's for sure.
No fair choice there. Yeah. Joe, what about you? Okay, I'll give you the same. So Simon Jones, Chaminda Vass, one of my probably all-time favourites from Sri Lanka. Shoaib Akhtar and Syed Ajmal. Who would you least like to face?
Probably going to go Shoaib Akhtar, to be honest.
Well, I didn't include Shoaib because he very rarely bowled in the nets, to be honest. They wouldn't let him. So so never really. He used to bowl in the middle to a mitt a lot of the time. lazy is probably the wrong word, but he wasn't. His work ethic probably wasn't as what you'd like. So he didn't bowl a massive amount in practice or in the nets. But when he did bowl, it was generally in the middle. Unfortunately, not at me. So that was a positive. So I left him out of the equation.
Fair enough, then. Yeah, but I'll probably go for Shovatar there. I think the person I'd most like to face is Syed Ajmal.
With the doozer, though.
Yeah. It'd just be interesting to see how long it would take. How long it would survive.
It's in the nets as well. You're not bothered about getting out, are you? It's actually, you just want to come out there unscathed and still have 10 fingers and not get your face filled in by somebody. So that's why, yeah.
In a match, I don't know. That's a whole different thing.
Yeah, but, yeah. No, I agree.
I don't know. For me, see, the thing with Akhtar, I'm not a great batsman, but knowing me, I'd want to go for a pull shot. I just would. There's just something inside me. I love the pull and the hook. So least like to face. I would face Ajmal because I'm a spinner, and I'd hope that I could maybe one in four chance of picking him. I don't know. I'd want to go for Vash just because I liked him. And the man with five first names as well. Yeah, for those who don't know, I think his name was Warner Kulasuriya Padabendiga Ushanta Joseph Chaminda Vass.
That is great knowledge.
Very good name as well.
355 test wickets, 400 ODI wickets. One of my all-time favourites. Not many people would know that, but I do like Chaminda.
Not a bad bowler.
Go with him. No, not a bad bowler at all. So yeah, that does conclude our fan questions. And of course, for anyone listening to this at home, if you want to get some fan questions in for our next podcast, feel free to send them into our Twitter at @thecountycrick2. But to wrap up today's podcast then, Daryl, we move on to everyone's quickly becoming favourite segment, I suppose, which is teammates. So we're going to ask you a selection of questions about your Worcestershire teammates, ranging from all sorts of topics. So Daryl Mitchell, are you ready for teammates?
Yes.
Brilliant. So we'll kickstart teammates then with a classic question. Who is Worcestershire's teacher's pet?
Joe Leach. 100%. Joe Leach is obviously club captain, but he's just never out of the coach's office. So I'm going to go for him on that.
Understandable.
A new one for the second question, and that is the best nickname at Worcester. Obviously, we talked about your darts nickname a little bit earlier.
I'm going to go for Clunesy, which is Jack Haynes, because he looks like Martin Clunes out of Menbehaving Badly. So you need to get a picture and Google it and put them side by side. He's like a young Martin Clunes. So I'm going to go for Clunesy on that one. Fitting image.
Fair enough. That is an idea for the Twitter.
Yeah, absolutely.
Moving on to the next one then. Another classic. Who is the dressing room DJ and what is the choice of music?
Coxie, I would say, probably has bigger impact on the speaker than anyone at the moment. He's got this playlist. He's called it Sax, I think, off Spotify or one of these. And it's a lot of sort of, it's just quite a good vibe, actually. He's quite good. I'll give him credit. I don't like to give Coxie credit very often, but on that, it's pretty good. He's got a couple of good playlists on there with sort of saxophones on and stuff. So I quite like that. It's difficult for me as the older statesman, and my musical tastes are very different to a lot of the younger lads. So, but Coxie generally finds the right balance, which is a good thing.
Fair enough. And I guess sticking with a similar theme, Karaoke King.
Dylan Peddington, he's recently learning the guitar. So Josh Tongue, who was his housemate, they've moved out now, actually. They both bought houses, but he was constantly recording him on Snapchat or Instagram, singing away to himself from the guitar. So
what's his go-to?
Under Covert. A little bit of Boyzone or Westlife, one of those was his go-to. I can't remember what the song was now. He always singing it. It was definitely Boyzone because it was Ronan Keating. Oh, what was the song? I can't remember. But one of those, anyway.
I'll be honest, I wasn't expecting Boyzone. Maybe something like Ed Sheeran or something.
He's a beginner, so I think he was just sort of strumming the same chord three times. So it was easier to do to Boyzone than anything else, I reckon.
Fair enough. And again, almost on the same similar vein of topic then, who is Mr. Dodgy Dance Moves?
Dodgy Dance Moves. Oh, that is a tough one. There's a few. Oh, who do I go for? I'm going to go Brownie. Just purely because his feet are too big. He's got like size 14 feet or something. So, yeah, he obviously can't dance as a result. So I'm going to go with Brownie on that one.
So the next question then is biggest diva.
Oh, Coxie. Definitely. Yeah, everything's an issue with him. Moans about everything. Very high maintenance. He'll go out to bat and have his jumper on, full kit, and within an over he'll be a 12-man's nightmare, running out looking after him, taking him drinks, and he gets low on sugar, so he wants some sugar out there, and he has his jumper taken off, then he'll put it back on, and yeah, nightmare, 12-man's nightmare. So I'm going to definitely cop it. That's the easiest one so far.
Fair enough. Ben, if you want to defend yourself on the podcast, feel free to.
Absolutely. Highest maintenance man in cricket, I reckon, Coxie.
Brilliant. Moving on to the next one, another one that's becoming a classic here on Teammates, but the selfie addict. Who's addicted to their social media?
I can't get cocksy again, can I? I've got to get someone else. Josh Tongue. Yeah, Josh Tongue, particularly since he's got a new girlfriend, actually. He's been all over it the last few weeks and maybe a couple of months. Instagram, especially. Yeah, so yeah, definitely Tonguey.
But Coxie's up there as well.
Yeah, Coxie's again. Up there as well, yeah. If I hadn't just said Coxie before, I'd have gone Coxie for that one, definitely. But we'll go with Tonguey.
The next one is the best dressed and the worst dressed.
Best dressed and the worst dressed. The worst is easy. Charlie Morris is 40-year-old geography teacher. Everything's cream or navy. Boat shoes, that lot. So, yeah, polos and boat shoes. That's Moz, definitely. Best dressed, I'm going to go Brett D'Oliveira. Cool man. Yeah, I like very different to everybody else, but he generally nails it. So I'm going to go with Donny.
Yeah, fair choice. That he seems quite fashion savvy.
Yeah, he's cool. He's cool. I like that. If I could choose to be anybody, it'd be Dolly, I reckon.
Fair enough. Moving on to the next one. A bit more cricket related, this one. Who is the biggest badger?
Can I have coaches in this? Because Alan Richardson is the ultimate cricket badger. Stats. He knows everyone's stats. He knows what they do. So I go him. The other one who runs in close, actually, is probably Ricky Vessels. He claims to hate cricket and have no interest, but he knows everything there is to know about everybody. So he puts on an act to try and hide it, but he is a cricket badger, loves it. Always on scorecards, looking at what's happening around the country and tells everyone what's going on at Notts and wherever else. So Ricky's up there as well.
Fair enough. Yeah, experience with Ricky Vessels.
Yeah. But yeah, absolute badger.
The next one, again, bit of a classic one, I would say. Dressing room joker.
I'd actually say me, I reckon, more than I tend to only in retaliation, but I tend to go to extremes if someone does something to me. So you get the classic, like, socks being cut or shoes glued to the floor and that. And then if it happens to me, I end up bubble wrapping someone's car or something, or various other things, nicking their cars, hiding their cars. So yeah,
that's probably. That's frankly pulled then.
I did a second team game, it's years ago now. We were on an away trip and the guy in question put a jalapeno pepper around my bottle that I was drinking at dinner. So obviously burnt lips and all that sort of stuff. So about a week later, he was out batting and we were playing at Ombersley Cricket Club and I nicked his car and hid it in the pub car park about 200 yards away and just left him a note and he had to get a taxi home that night. I did pick him up in the morning to take him to day two or day three or whatever it was. So he didn't have to. But yeah, I reckon that was a good one. Or I broke into Jack Shantra's house once he taped my bat up. So I nicked his. He fell asleep on the bus. So I nicked his car keys, drove his car back to his house and let myself in and trashed the place and put a kettle on. And when he came back with the taxi, I gave him a cup of tea. So a bit of redemption. So probably, yeah, one of them two, I think. Maybe a bit extreme at times, but I'm just nobody messes with me anymore, which is the most important thing.
Gotta do what you gotta do, aren't you?
That's it, yeah.
That was on the PCA website, that's why we asked that. I mean, what a story. I don't think that's something I'd ever even think of. Very creative, Daryl, to do that.
Well, yeah. I mean, you get rainy days and things, you get a lot of thinking time as a cricketer, so it's easy to put these sort of plans into action without a doubt.
Fair enough. At least you got a bit of humour. So moving on to the penultimate question for today then. Now, this is an interesting one. But who is Mr. Thinks He's Bear Grylls? Who would you trust in a survival situation?
Again, Mozza. This is, yeah, an easy one. Can't go. He's. I think his dad was in the Marines or something. I think Mozza's plan was to be a Marine if cricket didn't work out. And he trains phenomenally and he knows everything there is about the military and that kind of thing. So if I was to be stuck on a hill somewhere in the middle of nowhere, I wouldn't Mozza to help me survive, certainly.
Yeah, fair enough. And then the final question, best footballer?
Yeah, that's a difficult one. I'm going to go Ed Barnard, certainly the most skillful, talented footballer. Probably lacks a bit of end product though in the final sides we have, I reckon. Whereas I probably have more influence in the game as a bit of a Lee Catamol type in the middle, kicking a few and that and having a bit more influence in the game. But out and out, skillful, talent-wise, Barney is definitely the best footballer in the group, I would say. He's very good footballer.
So then, that wraps up Teammates for today then, Daryl. So just before we conclude today's podcast then, do you have anything to kind of plug or promote? Social media channels, for example?
No, not really. I'm on Instagram and Twitter, I guess. at Mitch WCCC, I think, on Twitter. I can't remember what my Instagram handle is, but I'm sure you'll find me if you want to.
Fair enough. So yeah, anyone listening, go give Daryl a follow then. But that does bring us to an end for today's episode of the County Cricket Podcast then. Just before we end, Daryl, from us too here, we just want to say a massive thank you. You've been a fantastic guest. It's been a very, very interesting and quite funny conversation at times as well.
Thanks for having me. It's been enjoyable.
That's what we like to hear. But yeah, that does bring us to an end for today's episode then. So everyone who has tuned in today, thank you very much for listening. And as always, guys, we'll see you on the next one.